A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about relaxation. Not the spa music and candles version, but why the things that actually turn our brains off are so specific and personal. He points out there are these universal tropes, right? Lying on a beach, doing a crossword, taking a long bath. But for a lot of people, those don't land at all, or they land differently depending on the day. His question is, what if relaxation isn't one switch we all share, but a set of individualized tools? And if that's true, how do we figure out what our own tools actually are, and how do we access them?
This is one of those questions where the framing already does half the work. Because most of the relaxation advice floating around assumes there's a single physiological off-ramp. Activate the parasympathetic nervous system, lower cortisol, and you're done. The technique is almost interchangeable. Deep breathing, progressive muscle relaxation, guided imagery, pick one. But the assumption that the path to that state is the same for everyone is, it's not just wrong, it's actively counterproductive for a big chunk of the population.
So if the universal tropes don't hold up, what's actually going on?
The core problem is what I'd call relaxation response heterogeneity. Same activity, wildly different neurological outcomes. Take meditation. For some people, it reliably drops blood pressure and quiets the amygdala. For others, and this is well documented clinically, it triggers anxiety, dissociation, or a kind of restless agitation that's worse than the stress they came in with. A 2017 study out of Brown found that about 8% of people who try meditation have a negative experience, and for about a quarter of those, it's severe enough to stop. That's not a failure of the person. That's a mismatch between the tool and the brain it's being applied to.
8% doesn't sound huge until you realize that's millions of people being told the thing that's supposed to fix them is making it worse, and they think they're the problem.
And it's not just meditation. The same heterogeneity shows up for nature walks, for music, for silence. Some people's nervous systems interpret silence as a threat. Their auditory cortex starts generating phantom input, and suddenly the quiet room is louder than the street. That's not a preference. That's a neurological wiring difference.
So we need to shift from asking what's relaxing to asking what's relaxing for this specific brain, in this specific state, right now.
That's the whole episode right there. And I think the way to ground this is to look at three mechanisms that explain why the variation exists in the first place. Because once you see the mechanism, the weirdly specific thing that works for you stops looking like a personal failing and starts looking like an adaptation.
Let's look under the hood at three mechanisms that explain why your brain's relaxation switch might look completely different from your partner's.
First one is sensory processing sensitivity. Roughly 20 to 30% of the population scores high on this trait. It's sometimes called the highly sensitive person trait, though that label's gotten a bit pop psychology. The actual neurological finding is that high SPS brains process sensory information more deeply and don't filter out background stimuli the same way. The thalamus, which is basically the brain's bouncer, deciding what sensory information gets through to the cortex, is more permissive in these individuals.
So the quiet spa with the gentle flute music isn't quiet for them. Their brain is still processing the hum of the ventilation system. The texture of the robe, the faint smell of eucalyptus, the fact that someone three rooms over is having a whispered conversation.
And that's exactly why the standard relaxation prescription can backfire. The instruction is, remove stimulation. But for a high SPS brain, removing stimulation just turns up the gain on whatever stimulation remains. What actually works is controlled sensory input, specific, predictable, chosen stimulation that gives the brain something safe to process. Weighted blankets are a classic example. The pressure provides a steady, predictable tactile signal that occupies the sensory channel without overwhelming it.
I've heard people describe weighted blankets as feeling like a hug that doesn't end, which is an interesting image. But it's not about emotional comfort. It's about giving the sensory system a job.
Deep pressure stimulation activates the parasympathetic system through a fairly direct pathway. it triggers mechanoreceptors under the skin that signal safety to the brainstem. But here's the key. It only works if the pressure is the right amount for that person. Too light, and it's irritating. Too heavy, and it's claustrophobic. The individualized tool isn't just the category of thing. It's the specific parameters.
Which means the person who relaxes by knitting isn't just keeping their hands busy. They're delivering a very specific set of sensory inputs. The texture of the yarn, the repetitive motion, the visual pattern emerging, that their particular nervous system finds regulating.
And the person next to them who finds knitting maddening isn't being difficult. Their sensory profile is different. Second mechanism. This one's about cognitive load and the default mode network. The default mode network is the set of brain regions that lights up when you're not focused on an external task. It's the mind-wandering network, the autobiographical memory network, the what's wrong with my life network.
The 3 a.m. network.
It's most active at 3 a.m., yes. And here's the problem. For people with ADHD or anxiety disorders, the default mode network doesn't quiet down properly when it should. Normally, when you engage in a focused task, the task positive network activates and the default mode network deactivates. They're kind of a seesaw. But in ADHD brains, that deactivation is weaker. The DMN keeps intruding. So when you tell someone with ADHD to just sit quietly and do nothing, you're not giving them relaxation. You're giving them an unmoderated session with their own intrusive thoughts.
This explains why doing nothing is actively stressful for some brains. It's not a character flaw. The seesaw is stuck.
And the individualized tool for these brains is often a low cognitive load task that occupies just enough attention to suppress the default mode network without being so demanding that it becomes a new source of stress. The sweet spot is something that's engaging but not challenging. A repetitive video game, sorting objects, folding laundry, doing a jigsaw puzzle.
The jigsaw puzzle is such a perfect example. It has no stakes, it has clear visual feedback, it has a defined endpoint, and it occupies your pattern-matching systems just enough that the ruminative loop can't get a word in edgewise.
There's a reason puzzles had a massive resurgence during the pandemic. People were stuck at home with their thoughts and needed something to keep the DMN occupied. It wasn't escapism exactly, it was cognitive traffic management.
Third mechanism. You mentioned the autonomic nervous system baseline.
Right. People have different resting balances between the sympathetic nervous system, the accelerator, and the parasympathetic, the brake. Some people run chronically high on sympathetic activation. They're the ones who startle easily, who feel on edge even when nothing's wrong, whose baseline cortisol trends higher. For them, relaxation does need to involve active parasympathetic stimulation. Slow breathing, cold exposure, vagus nerve stimulation, things that physically signal the body to downshift.
But there's a flip side to this.
There is. Some people run chronically low on sympathetic activation. They're under-aroused at baseline. They might feel sluggish, foggy, unmotivated. For them, trying to relax further through deep breathing or meditation can actually make things worse. It pushes them deeper into the low arousal zone where they feel dissociated or depressed. What they need is mild stimulation to bring them up to an optimal arousal level first, and then they can downshift naturally. A brisk walk, upbeat music, a stimulating conversation. These aren't distractions from relaxation, they're the prerequisite for it.
So the arousal curve isn't a simple on-off switch. It's more like a U-shaped thing where the sweet spot is in the middle.
The Yerkes-Dodson curve, originally described in 1908, it's one of the oldest findings in psychology and it holds up remarkably well. Performance and well-being peak at moderate arousal and drop off at both extremes. Too little stimulation and you're bored, which is stressful. Too much and you're anxious, which is stressful. The individualized relaxation tool is whatever moves you into that middle zone, and the crucial thing is that the zone shifts. It shifts across the day, it shifts with your overall stress load, it shifts with whether you slept well. What worked at 10 a.m. might not work at 4 p.m.
This is where the whole idea of having one relaxation practice falls apart. It's not one tool. It's a toolkit, and you're recalibrating constantly.
And most people are already doing this intuitively without naming it. They come home from a day of back-to-back meetings, high cognitive load, high social demand, and they don't want to meditate. They want to chop vegetables. Or they come home from a day of solitary focused work, and they want to call a friend. They're self-regulating based on what their nervous system is missing.
The person who finds cooking relaxing, not because it's mindless, but because it provides structured sensory engagement, immediate feedback, and a clear endpoint. That's not a relaxation activity in the wellness industry sense, but it's hitting all the right buttons.
Flow states are underrated as a relaxation mechanism. Activities that are challenging enough to absorb attention but not so challenging as to cause anxiety. They produce a state where self-consciousness drops away, time perception shifts, and the brain's stress circuits go quiet. Csikszentmihalyi's original flow research found that people report flow states as some of the most satisfying experiences of their lives, and they're often not restful in the conventional sense. A rock climber in flow is working hard physically, but their brain is in a state that looks a lot like deep relaxation on an EEG.
So we've established that relaxation is heterogeneous, but here's where it gets weird. The very act of trying to relax can break the mechanism.
The relaxation paradox. This is especially brutal for high achievers and perfectionists. You tell them to relax, and they immediately turn it into a task. I need to relax. Am I relaxing yet? Is my breathing deep enough? Should my heart rate be lower? The metacognitive monitoring, the part of the brain that's evaluating whether you're doing it right, that's the task positive network. You're supposed to be quieting that network, but the instruction to relax has just activated it.
Performance anxiety. But the performance is doing nothing.
And the more you care about getting it right, the worse it gets. This is why the most effective relaxation tools for some people are indirect, activities whose primary purpose isn't relaxation, but that produce relaxation as a byproduct. You're not cooking to relax, you're cooking to make dinner. The relaxation happens because your brain is occupied with something else, and the stress circuits get a chance to power down without anyone watching.
The watched pot never relaxes.
There's a knock-on effect around the social dimension, too. Relaxation is almost always framed as a solitary activity. Go somewhere quiet, be alone with your thoughts, disconnect. But for extroverts, or for people with certain attachment styles, social connection is the primary relaxation trigger. Co-regulation. The process where being in the presence of a calm other person stabilizes your own nervous system is a well-documented phenomenon in attachment theory and interpersonal neurobiology. It's not a preference. It's a physiological mechanism. The presence of a regulated nervous system helps regulate yours through things like vocal tone, facial expression, and even heart rate synchronization.
So the person who can't relax alone isn't broken. Their relaxation tool just requires another person in the room.
And yet the cultural script says real relaxation is solitary. You see this in the way people apologize for needing company to decompress, as if it's a less mature form of self-care. It's not. It's a different neurological pathway to the same state.
The temporal thing you mentioned. The same activity working at one time and not another. That feels important.
It's huge, and it's the part most wellness advice completely ignores. A run might clear your head beautifully after a day of mental work. You're physically tired but cognitively underloaded, so the exercise brings you into that optimal zone. But if you're already physically exhausted from poor sleep or manual labor, that same run spikes cortisol and leaves you more depleted. The tool didn't change. The context did.
Which means the individualized tool isn't a fixed activity at all. It's a dynamic calibration.
And that's where the practical question Daniel asked comes in. How do you actually identify what works for you? Because most people, when asked what relaxes them, reach for the cultural script. They say reading, or a bath, or listening to music, because those are the approved answers. But if you actually track what leaves you feeling restored, the answers are often much weirder and more specific.
What's the better question?
Instead of asking what relaxes me, ask when was the last time I finished an activity and felt restored, not just less stressed, actually replenished. Then work backward from that moment. What were the sensory conditions? What was the cognitive demand level? Were you alone or with someone? What time of day was it? What had you been doing beforehand? The tool isn't the activity label, it's the condition set. The activity is just the delivery mechanism for the conditions.
It's pattern recognition, not prescription.
The patterns are often surprising. You might discover that you feel most restored after activities that involve organizing things. Not because you love tidying, but because categorization tasks occupy a specific cognitive bandwidth that quiets your particular flavor of rumination. Or you might find that the common thread is being near moving water, or being in a space with high ceilings, or having your hands in soil. These aren't trivial details, they're the actual active ingredients.
The danger here is what I'd call relaxation optimization. The same productivity mindset that creates stress can colonize relaxation. You start tracking your restoration metrics. You build a relaxation routine. You optimize your wind down protocol. And suddenly relaxing is another thing you're trying to be good at.
This is the paradox at the center of the whole thing. Treating relaxation as a skill to be optimized can undermine the very state you're trying to achieve. The individualized tool may require surrendering the goal of relaxation entirely, doing the thing for its own sake and letting the restoration happen as a side effect.
The person who alphabetizes their spice rack not because it's a relaxation technique, but because they want their spices alphabetized, and then they notice, afterward, that they feel better.
They might never tell anyone, because it sounds absurd, but that's the whole point. The things that actually regulate our nervous systems are often specific to the point of being embarrassing. The wellness industry wants to sell you a universal solution because universal solutions scale. But your nervous system didn't get the memo about scalability.
1997. I designed unwinding experiences for a corporate retreat company in Marin County.
Unwinding experiences.
That was the job title, relaxation consultant. I made $62,000 a year plus benefits. The program was the same for everyone. Morning yoga, guided journaling, silent meals, an afternoon nature walk, evening meditation. 4 days. The brochure called it The Reset. Capital T, capital R.
How'd that go?
About a third of the clients loved it. Wept with relief, wrote testimonials, sent their spouses the next year. Another third got through it fine. The last third got visibly worse. More tense by day two, snapping at the facilitators, one guy threw a journal into a pond. The company's position was that those clients weren't ready to receive the experience. I said maybe the experience wasn't right for those clients. They said personalization would dilute the brand. I quit in August of 98.
You saw the heterogeneity problem firsthand, before anyone was calling it that.
I didn't have the vocabulary for it. I just knew the same program was healing some people and hurting others, and the company had a financial interest in pretending that wasn't true. What I learned later is that traditional cultures never made this mistake. The Japanese concept of ma, the pause, the negative space, it's not a prescription, it's context dependent. The right kind of pause depends on what you're pausing from. A farmer's ma and a scribe's ma are different things. The industrial standardization of relaxation is new, and it's not about health. It's about packaging something you can sell at scale.
The retreat model is basically a factory for relaxation experiences.
A factory has to produce the same thing every time. That's what makes it a factory. My brother-in-law runs a high-end spa in Scottsdale. He told me once that the most relaxed he's ever seen a client was a woman who spent her entire 3-day stay reorganizing the spa's supply closet. Didn't attend a single scheduled activity, just asked if she could fix the inventory system. The staff thought she was having a breakdown. He let her do it. She wrote him a thank you note saying it was the best vacation of her life.
She found her tool.
She found her tool. My brother-in-law isn't someone whose opinion I'd trust on most things. He once tried to convince me that drinking water has a memory, but on this one thing, he's right. The tool is specific, and it doesn't care whether it looks like relaxation from the outside.
What's yours?
Alphabetizing my spice rack by country of origin. Cumin goes under I for India, sumac under L for Lebanon, paprika under H for Hungary. It takes about 40 minutes. It occupies exactly the right amount of cognitive bandwidth. Enough that my brain can't spin, not enough that it's work. I've never told anyone that before because it sounds like something a person says right before they're institutionalized. But it works better than any meditation app I've tried.
The specificity is the point. The app doesn't know you need Hungarian paprika to land in the right category.
The app wants me to breathe deeply and visualize a forest. My brain doesn't want a forest. My brain wants to adjudicate the geographic origin of dried herbs.
There's something almost beautiful about that. The thing that quiets your particular mind is a taxonomy problem.
I don't know about beautiful, but it's mine. And I think that's what you two have been saying for the last 20 minutes. The tool is yours. Nobody can sell it to you because they don't know what shape your brain is.
Where does that leave us? If relaxation is this individualized, what does that mean for the entire wellness industry built on universal prescriptions?
The industry is in a bind. Personalization doesn't scale the way a meditation app scales. But the alternative is selling a product that actively harms a significant portion of its users. we're already seeing some movement toward personalization. Wearable devices that can detect when you're in the optimal arousal zone and suggest context-specific activities. But the risk is that this becomes another optimization treadmill. Your watch tells you you're stressed, suggests a breathing exercise, and now you're stressed about whether you're doing the breathing exercise correctly.
The quantified self meets the unquantifiable nervous system.
The nervous system wins every time, because the thing that actually shifts you into a regulated state might be something no algorithm would ever suggest. It might be alphabetizing spices. It might be reorganizing a supply closet. It might be sitting in a parked car in a grocery store parking lot for 7 minutes, which, by the way, is a thing multiple people have told me they do, and none of them had ever admitted it to anyone else.
The parking lot thing. I've heard that one too. It's the transition space. You're not home yet, you're not shopping anymore, you're in a liminal zone where nothing is expected of you.
If you told a wellness consultant that your relaxation practice was sitting in a parked car outside a Safeway, they'd try to fix you. But you're not broken, you found a thing that works.
Maybe the most relaxing thing you can do is stop trying to relax the right way.
That might be the whole conclusion. The search for the correct relaxation technique is itself a form of striving. And striving is what got your nervous system dysregulated in the first place. The individualized tool isn't something you discover by trying harder. It's something you notice in retrospect after you've already done it.
This has been my Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop, who apparently has strong opinions about spice taxonomy.
If you have a weirdly specific relaxation ritual, especially one you've never told anyone because it sounds absurd, we want to hear about it. Email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.